Broadcasting on 103.2, this is Dublin City FM.
Hello, good evening and welcome to the Astronomy Show here on 103.2 Dublin City FM with John Dixon and myself, Ben Emmett. Our email address is astronomy@dublincityfm.ie and the text and WhatsApp number is 087-179-1032. That's 087-179-1032. We're also live on the internet at dublincityfm.ie and as a podcast. And I think we've, thank you to Will in Spain for alerting us yet again that there are apparently some problems with the podcast, and I will have a look and ask some people about that. But more of that anon, and we will start with lots to get through this evening. Meteors, death in space, all sorts of cheerful things like that, and coronal mass ejections, and the good news from Voyager 2. But we'll start, as usual, what to see in the night sky.
Now, and good evening, everyone, including you, Mr. Ben.
Thank you very much.
Tuesday
good evening.
Again. Tuesday again. Right. What's happening in our skies at the moment? No International Space Station just at the moment. But it is back in September the 14th, which is not really that far away, is it?
Where are we? Three or four weeks.
Yes. Yeah. It's really strange.
4 weeks.
Yep. There we go. But what to see in the sky at the moment? Mercury is very low in bright twilight, starting about 20 to 30 minutes after sunset, just depending where you are. And if you want to see it, just use binoculars to look for it just above the horizon, due west. If you can find it, can you spot fainter Mars in this vicinity as well? So there's a test for you. And Venus is unfortunately out of sight at the moment, so in inferior conjunction with the Sun. It disappeared quite rapidly out of the skies over the last number of weeks, but it will appear in the morning skies soon. We'll alert you to that as well. Mars is faint, plus 1.8. Very dim at the moment. It's the next brightest thing near Mercury. And you've got to use binoculars to look for it about 7 degrees above the upper left of Mercury. And that's where it is just at the moment. Jupiter, pretty good sight at the moment, minus 2.5. I have seen it. And it rises just before midnight. So watch for it to come up low in the east-northeast by the beginning of dawn. It shines very high towards the southeast. We get a picture of that. Oh, yes. Okay, we have that. Saturn, plus 0.5, quite dim in Aquarius. It rises in twilight, and it's nearing its 26th of August opposition. And after dark, Saturn glows as the brightest thing low in the east-southeast. It's highest in the south and sharpest and steadiest in a telescope around 1 or 2 a.m., in daylight saving time, of course. And the two elusive ones, our favourite planets, Uranus, Neptune, plus 5.7. And Neptune, very, very difficult to see. Neptune rises just around nightfall and is high in the south just before dawn, about 20 degrees east of Saturn. I'm going to scribble that down and play the recording back. You'll find out where it is. Uranus, on the other hand, is nice and high just before dawn, about 9 degrees east of Jupiter. So that's what to see in the sky. Just put the date again in for the space station, September the 14th. We have a meteor shower coming up.
The Perseids, best one of the year. This year, unlike last year, if I remember correctly, this year the moon will be out of the way. I'll talk about the moon phases in a moment, but on the night of the 12th and the 13th, it reaches maximum, and the moon that night won't rise until the early hours of the 13th, about 2 a.m. So if you're up around, and midnight and 1 a.m. is probably around the best time to catch them. You may have more details on that, John?
Well, I wanted to talk about the brilliant fireball that was seen.
Oh.
This seemingly belongs to the Perseids. It was seen in America across 74 different reports. And lucky enough, I have seen the video.
Oh,
and there was a lot of people with telescopes watching this. It was brighter than the moon. It came a came in and it created sonic booms, which it would mean that it's pretty close to wherever people are watching. And just, I don't know whether you can see the photograph, which is the moon. There you go. The one on the top is the moon. So, and if there is a video online if you want to watch this as well. And some of the people have said they've never seen anything like it. The initial flash was brilliant and brighter than a street light in the yard. And the light brilliance was enough to overpower current full moon in the east. So it was pretty bright. And I love seeing big, bright things like that because they stay around for a few seconds. So they reckon this was a comet fragment around 30 cm in diameter and a weight close to about 34 kilos. So that's why,
that's why
it took a little while to blaze through the sky. Now, if there was anything left, we're not just sure on this. So it entered the atmosphere about 50 miles above Kentucky Town and moving roughly southeast about 37,000 miles an hour. So that's quite quick. No wonder they heard sonic booms. And the object travelled 65 miles through the atmosphere before disintegrating 30 miles above a place called Duffield in Virginia.
That sounds like it's more likely any pieces, if they did reach the surface, would have fallen into the sea.
Yeah, it's, I doubt very much that it's not really big enough. You need a really big one. A monstrously big one. So that was seen the other day. So we have, going back to the Perseids. These are brilliant. You see about 120 per hour at
under ideal conditions.
Yeah.
With no, not a cloud, not a wisp of moonlight, and far away, of course, from any street light or any artificial light at all. That's the theoretical maximum. Would be zenith hourly
rate. Yeah.
That's 120. That's 2 a minute, one every 30 seconds. But you'd want to be really lucky to get that. But you should see one every couple of minutes, though.
There was a couple of years back where I did get to see a number because it was pretty clear. Most of the time it's just cloudy. It's really disappointing. But they really come from anywhere in the sky. They base themselves from Perseus.
If you follow the tracks back from any of they all seem to originate from Perseus, which is why they're called the Perseids. But you can't see them in any part of the sky.
Yeah,
but that's where they would appear to originate.
So set your camera on a long exposure.
That might work. That might work indeed. That would be good. So that's next week. Also this week, just sticking with the planets, before I get to the moon and sun, of course, Mercury. Tomorrow, Mercury is at dichotomy. So if you have a telescope and you can pick it out, you will see a phase, a sort of first quarter or third quarter phase. And also tomorrow evening, the Pleiades are 5¾ degrees to the upper right of the moon. Thursday the 10th is a good day to look out for Mercury because it will be at its greatest elongation east, over almost 27 arc seconds, or 27 arc minutes, I should say, 27 and a half arc minutes. And as we mentioned already, in the early hours of a Sunday, the Perseids peak around about 3 a.m. And on Monday the 14th, Jupiter is 7 degrees to the upper left of the moon. So that's a good pointer for you if you're looking for, if you're not sure how to find Jupiter next Monday evening. Look to the upper left of the moon, but 7 degrees, which is a bit less than the width of your fist at arm's length. And that bright object is Jupiter. Actually, if you have binoculars, you should be able to pick out. You will see a disk, so you know it's not a star, because all stars will look at, when they're focused, when you're focused on the star, it'll just appear as a point of light and not a disk. And you should be able to see a couple of the moons as well of Jupiter in a straight line across. A very impressive sight, even in kind of average 8x50 binoculars. You can see those little points of light. Very nice. Back to the moon. We had last quarter moon this morning, about 10:30. It's not above our horizon at the moment here in Dublin, but it will rise later this evening, just about 11:30, when it'll be a 44% waning crescent phase. And it'll be due south just before 8 a.m. tomorrow morning. And when it'll set tomorrow afternoon, rather, at about just before 4:30 in the afternoon, and rises tomorrow again just before midnight. At that stage, it'll be down from its current 46% phase to a 34% phase. Now, the sun rises tomorrow in Dublin at 5:54 a.m., so that's 12 minutes later than a week ago. And the sunset times and twilight times, they're all about 14 to 20 minutes later than a week ago, too. Local noon in Dublin is 1:30 p.m. exactly, and the sun sets at 9:05. Who'd believe it? Already it just seems to be going so quickly, which is 14 minutes earlier than a week ago. And from then until 9:45, we'll have civil twilight. And from 9:45 until about 10:40, we'll have nautical twilight. And then just before midnight, or 5 minutes to midnight, astronomical twilight will end and nighttime will begin. So that means we'll have 26 minutes less daylight than a week ago. Tomorrow there'll be another 3 minutes and 40 seconds less daylight than today, when we'll have 15 hours and 12 minutes between sunrise and sunset.
Mm. I was talking to a pal, Richard, in Birmingham this morning. And he's gone recently and he's bought himself a nice telescope, and he's been out taking photographs and produced some really good ones, I must say, so from the ones I've seen anyway. But he was out, was it sometime last week, looking for Saturn because he'd never seen it before. So he went out and got a glimpse of it. Of course, he said, wow, this is the first time I'm seeing this. Of course, the clouds came rolling in. I says, I'll give that a few minutes just before I come back out again. Mm-hmm. So we did, he gave it about half an hour, and he came back out, and Jupiter, or Saturn, was gone. That just shows you how quickly it moves out of the sky down below the horizon. So he was a little bit perturbed with that one, but he knows that, well, it will come back, of course, that's the thing. But he said, the first sight of Saturn is remarkable, as you and I would well know.
Oh, yes, yes. Actually, the first time I saw Saturn was through the telescope of the Dunsink Observatory.
Was it? Yeah, my first one through there was Vega. It was just a bright star, just a new star. Mm. So,
well, it's not very interesting looking at it's individual not. Stars. No. I mean, looking at galaxies and star clusters are, and double stars, variable stars, like, or not variable, well, variable stars, but double star systems like Albireo, at the bottom is Cygnus. They're kind of interesting because you can see the two different colors of them, the two different colored stars, two different temperatures. But generally, you're looking at, to look at planets and galaxies and star clusters like M13 or certain nebulae like the Dumbbell Nebula or the Bulbul Nebula. But looking at individual stars themselves is not particularly
interesting. Must say I do like watching the Orion's Belt. Is it M64?
You never 42, is it?
42, whatever it is. And it's amazing. Really,
the sword is the Orion Nebula. M42.
It's amazing that the sight that we get through a telescope or binoculars, you don't get to see the colours that a photograph would emit, because it soaks up every colour. So what you're seeing through binoculars in a telescope is only a little bit towards, although it's still a fine sight, but if you can get a camera to catch the whole area, that's the way to do it, because you get a good reddish huey type of a colour. It's a fascinating sight. There are huge amount of things to see out there.
Millions, billions.
If you want to go into deep space,
But as you mentioned, things through a telescope, well, when you're looking at dim objects, when you're using your night vision, I can't remember, it's the rods or the cones. They're not very colour sensitive. That's why most things appear in their shades of black and white. Although, as I said earlier, with some of those double stars systems, you can see the different colours. But as you indicate, when you take a photograph in long exposure, the colours
jump out at you. Yeah, just if you are going out against the watching of the Perseid meteor shower, bring a reclining chair. They're the man, or one of the big lilo-y things that you can look straight up at, and then bring the cat out and a few things like that. So you have a good evening's watching. So it's
give your eyesight 20 minutes or so to get used to it.
Absolutely, and don't shine any bright lights anywhere.
No drinking or smoking, because that affects your vision.
Is that right now?
It is, yes.
I don't believe it. Not for one moment.
Okay, John, the cheerful subject of death in space. Let's cover that one.
Yeah.
Because someday we're going to go to Mars. People are going to settle on Mars, I have no doubt, and people are going to die on Mars. So what are we going to do with...
Normally I would pick these things up out of the internet, but this one appeared in front of me today. And as we know, the vacuum of space is unforgiving and time is not on our side whatsoever. So many of us, of course, have dreamed about going to space, and probably if you've imagined it, and even exploring new worlds, even Mars, the Moon, whatever. Spacesuits, of course, allow the astronauts to venture outside the spacecraft for short periods of protection. And I still find it amazing. You can go out for about 7 hours in a spacesuit without coming back in again. And I did just find that remarkable, the amount of time that they spend out there. So, if you were to be exposed to the vacuum of space without a spacesuit, within a very short time, in a matter of probably 10 to 15 seconds, you'll become unconscious because of the lack of oxygen. And the thing not to do there is to take a big deep breath before you go out, because it'll be swallowed up very quickly. Your whole insides will just expand. And it's going to be a serious problem. So you don't want to hold your breath before being thrust into outer space, because the oxygen that sustains us will become a more serious problem. So what happens? The oxygen starts expanding and rupturing your lungs, which is quite painful, I would imagine, tearing them apart. And that would cause the boiling and bubbling of your blood, which immediately will cause embolism, and then will have a fatal impact on your body. So divers would face the same type of thing when they're down deep low, with the nitrogen bubbles appearing in the blood, known as the bends. So everything would begin to boil and the human body would expand. You wouldn't explode, and then after about 45 minutes you'd freeze totally up. So that's the end. Simple as that.
Lovely.
It certainly is. You don't want to read the rest of this. It's gruesome.
We'll get back to that in a moment, perhaps. Yes. But you're listening to the Astronomy Show on 103.2 Dublin City FM with John Dixon and myself, Ben Emmett. Our email address is astronomy@dublincityfm.ie, and the text and WhatsApp number is 087-179-1032. And the thing about if an astronaut dies up, you know, in low Earth orbit or even on the Moon, I suppose the idea would be you would bring back the body, because I didn't say there's nowhere to bury it, but that would be the decent thing to do. Presumably there's family and that one would prefer to have the body. But if and when we get to Mars, you can't be burning the amount of energy it takes to cremate a body. You need that. You need to be very, very precious and conservative with the energy that you use, and also the body deteriorate and decompose, and that could cause a lot of contamination too. Presumably, you'll be trying also to grow some foodstuffs, maybe in tunnels or whatever. But there might be, again, that would be. That's a tricky one. If you're 300 miles away from Earth, I presume you could store the body sometime for an eventual return to Earth. But
it's not a subject that's often talked about. I don't know if anybody has actually died in space. I don't think so at this stage.
No. Not that we know of. Well, of course, you had the Challenger, which, well, that wasn't quite, that was, wasn't that, that was about 70-odd seconds after liftoff, so it wasn't in space. Mm. And then you had the Columbia. Was it? But that broke up on re-entry. So technically, they didn't die in space. But
you don't often hear if people are ill up there either. You know, they could be. When they go up first, they've got the tummy wobbles for a day or two. But after that, they seem to be A-okay. They're as absolutely fit as fiddles, these guys. The amount of exercise that they do as well. Anyway, just to change the subject, a couple of weeks ago, or two or three weeks ago, we heard that Voyager 2 had lost. We'd lost contact
somebody
with
Voyager
2. Somebody
had sent it. Somebody with the fat digit syndrome pressed the one button too many or some such and sent the incorrect command to the spacecraft, which then proceeded to point just about 2 degrees off.
It's enough, I suppose.
When you're 12 billion miles away, and you're pointing your signal back and it's 2 degrees off, over 12 million 12 billion miles. It must have missed the Earth by, I don't know how many. We could do the trigonometry. It's fairly basic trigonometry, all right. But
it seems to have happened. They lost contact. Now, they haven't got it back talking properly just yet, but Voyager 2 is still broadcasting a heartbeat, as they know it, from deep space after the communications breakdown. And this one was launched back in 1977, and I remember this. It's not yesterday or the day before. And it automatically sent a carrier signal picked up by the agency's deep space network, said the officials on August the 1st, which was only last week or so. But they haven't begun talking again, so whatever they're setting up to point it back in the right direction, it's looking good. That's that good thing, so. Yep, it's a bit like hearing a spacecraft's heartbeat, is the way they describe it. So
everything's going well. They hadn't expected to hear from it again until October, when it was due to reorientate itself back towards Earth. But everything seems to be going well. Thank goodness for that. They reckon also it'll run out of power. It works on kind of nuclear power battery, small little reactor, and there could be maybe 3 years power left in it. It's going to keep going, of course, because there's no friction stopping it. It's going to 40,000 miles an hour or thereabouts, and they reckon in about it'll be another 40,000 years at least before it goes anywhere near another star system, and probably go on for millions, billions, maybe trillions of years. Earth is gone,
it'll
be there. Alan's been in touch. Thank you, Alan, for your text. Just talking about on the subject of a debt in space. You were saying back on the Mir space station, the astronaut Michael Fole, I remember that name. He says Michael Fole claims he took a deep breath upon impact when the Mir space station, remember that time the probe or something to come to dock with it and it just bounced off, it came in too fast.
Mm-hmm.
But he says, of course, not really realizing that if the hull had been breached, as you indicate, John, he would have killed instantly.
Just a couple of things before we go. The Indian lunar landing mission enters its moon's orbit, so this is a good sign. And it entered the moon's orbit on Saturday ahead of the country's second attempt at a lunar landing as the cut-price space program seeks to reach new heights. So they've cut a little budget down a little bit on that. So the world's most populous nation has a comparatively low budget aerospace program that is rapidly closing in on the milestone set by global space powers. So it's not too much information about this just at the moment, but it seems to have entered the orbit. So we'll keep an eye on that over the next week or two to see what exactly happens. The other big thing is the sun blasting out the highest energy radiation ever recorded, which was raising questions for solar physics. Now, seemingly going back in a few years or so, one of the solar sunblasts or flares hit Earth, Mars, and somewhere else.
The moon.
The moon, that's it.
That's the first time they were detected on three different celestial bodies all at once.
So they reckon it's something like 1 trillion electron volts. And this is a big question about the radiation that people are going to feel when they get into space. They go to the moon, they go even further into Mars. And how are they going to protect space goers, I suppose, astronauts, cosmonauts, and anybody else who wants to go up there. So they've been looking at 6 years' worth of data on this, and they have an excess of gamma rays, which are not really good because they go straight through you and out the far side, even not quite as quickly as neutrinos, but certainly faster than X-rays. And it's a serious problem for space radiation for anybody who's travelling way into space.
And speaking of which, of course, space tourism is taking off again, literally and metaphorically. There's a new company called Space Perspective, and they've announced that they have sold more than 1,600 tickets on its spaceship Neptune, which is basically a high-altitude near-space balloon offering. And 1,600 is almost triple the number of people who have actually been to space at the moment. This seems to be a gentle six-hour ride into space, going at a absolutely unbelievable speed, approximately 12 miles an hour for 6 hours. But you go, you're just going straight up, and they will breach the Kármán line, which is 100 kilometres above the Earth, about 60 miles, which is officially the definition of reaching space, the lower limit of space. So everybody's in on the act. Of course, you have Blue Origin, Virgin Galactic, and the first person up was, who was the first one? Was that Dennis Tito? Yeah, he was back in 2002 or so. And it's reported he paid $20 million for his 6-day trip to the International Space Station.
Yeah, some trip all the same.
You won't get it for $20 million now.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. You won't. Now, the Cygnus space freighter arrived at the space station last Friday with about 4,000 kilos of cargo. Well, that's about 4 tons of cargo, so evidently they need a few bits and pieces up there. Of course, they'll come back with some of that. And the craft arrived at the orbital outpost at 5:52 Eastern EDT or 9:52 AM on Friday last. And they've got loads of stuff on board, little goodies and all sorts of things. Let me just see if we've got a list of what's on board. No, it's not giving me the thing. The water, of course.
The new
potable water dispenser, a PWD. Which provide the International Space Station crew with hot water and improved sanitization. So technology is getting better. And the memory card that contains creative works from students from around the world is up there. Cygnus also delivered the equipment needed for several cutting-edge ISS research projects. A load of these we never hear about, including human brain cells that will be cultured into 3D cell models. Wow, how technology has moved there. So, yep. All the usual stuff gone up, you know, all the experiments have to come back again. So, it'll be interesting to see when that comes back down, when they fill it back up again with junk.
Thank you very much, John. Very briefly, I see Russia is to launch its first lunar mission in 50 years. They plan to launch it on Friday. They are lagging behind now at Chinese, Americans, and even Indians, I suppose. And they plan to land a little four-legged lander weighing around 800 kilograms on the lunar south pole. And initially, of course, this plan or this mission had involved European and I think Canadian participation. But of course, the sanctions since they invaded Ukraine put an end to that. More on that, we'll keep you up to date with that. Of course, the Russians are more correctly, the Soviets were first with a lot of things in space. Of course, the first object, the first satellite, Sputnik 1, first man, Yuri Gagarin, first woman, what was her name? Tereshkova, Valentina Tereshkova, first dog. Yeah. Like, lots of first, first space walk. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That was, I can't remember that guy's name at the moment, but they're planning on going back there. Yeah. I think that's all the time we have this evening. Thank you, John, for the news items. And our email address is astronomy@dublincityfm.ie. Thanks too to James Sweeney for making the show available as a podcast and to Conor Lennon for putting it up on astronomy.ie. But that's all from me, Ben Emmett, from this edition of The Astronomy Show here on 103.2 Dublin City FM. Up next, it's Hello China, 9 o'clock, Threads with Bren Lynott, and 11 p.m. it's Ear to the Globe with Nigel Wood, and from midnight till 2 a.m., Dave Barry's After Hours program is a mix of jazz, blues and soul. But please join John.
Yes, that's me.
For the next 2 weeks, mm-hmm, when he'll be back with all the latest news from around the universe. Until then, take care of each other. Thank you for listening and say good night, John.
Good night, John.
Good night, John.
Bye bye.
Broadcasting on 103.2, this is Dublin City FM.